Live and direct from the 202 on a beautiful Sunday. Don't know why I'm going to post this, but it's a Sunday. It's the Global Citizen Podcast. Welcome back, everybody, to my most loyal listeners. Quick shout out to all essential workers. Your work is tough, and I appreciate you very much. And hopefully everyone's keeping safe. Today, I have a special guest. First time, long time. Actually, he's been on my show the most. Tristan, welcome back, man. Yeah.
Hey, thanks. Good to be back. I did not know that. That is like a honor and a privilege.
Oh, for me too, man. You know, you are like Global Citizen Hall of Fame guests already. No, but we hadn't checked in a while. I mean, we talk every day a little bit here and there, and then we had a call. Skype call, a few Skype calls, one where you were having dinner with your family.
Crazy dinner.
Yeah, because you have two kids under the age of four. Well, four and under, basically.
Yeah, the oldest one's about to turn four in a week and a half.
Oh, baby.
Yeah. So we're trying to figure out what a quarantine birthday is going to look like, because she's been talking about her birthday for 2, 3, 4 months.
Oh no! So, yeah. Build up.
We're working.
We spoke again on Skype when we just sat in silence while we did work, and you were sitting at the foot of your bed. But I know you're really busy, so thank you for taking time to join me.
Yeah, no, it's cool to connect. We got to do this time of this time in the world. Share info, how are you feeling? Tell stories.
Yeah, absolutely. How are you doing with the quarantine, with the family, with, you know,
it's a different spin-off. I think we're doing pretty well. We're lucky. You know, we both have our jobs. My partner and I both have our jobs. And kids, it's fun to be home. I mean, it's hard to be home with the kids, but you also get to see them in all these different ways, you know, that we don't normally get to see. So you get to see them grow and try things out. And it's kind of hard because they – you know, kids learn by failing. I mean, everyone learns by failing, but it's right. Really hard when you're a kid. Kids trying to learn how to walk up the stairs and they just face plant scrape their face up, or they're trying to learn how to use the bathroom, and it gets messy. But
accidents happen.
But yeah, we're lucky. You know, we're in Baltimore, and there's where we live. There's space. You know, we can get out and run around, and I don't know. It's we're lucky.
Cool, man. No, I hear you. I hear you on the space thing, because I feel like DC is getting more and more crowded now that the weather is getting nicer and nicer. So it's just kind of like before there was space to walk around without a mask. Now it's just like, I want to put my mask on.
Yeah. Yeah, and people are being pretty good about all that stuff here. I mean, we've got Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and
of course, the
leading institutions. Everyone's like pretty much on point with all that stuff, but it's still, I don't know. How are folks that you know in the Global Citizen Network dealing with this in other countries? Like, I don't know. I'm not hearing too much about what's happening elsewhere. I mean, just stories, but are there people you're in contact with that you hear what's like in other places?
Yeah, I mean, they're socially distancing. They're in most of the countries with the people I connect with, their rules are actually more strict than the U.S. rules are. They have strict curfews, but, you know, you still have people who aren't wearing masks. A lot of them live in places where there's just a lot of people. So they wear masks, but they're like packed on a bus. But the folks I connect with are, you know, definitely taking everything very seriously. But they're all scared also, but like I have friends in South Africa who are just can't go. It's like countries on like week, it's like day 54 lockdown where it's just like, they're not even selling alcohol. But here, you know, if you want, you can go to a bar, pick up your favorite drink and drink it in the park and make out with strangers and everything will be fine.
Yeah. It's, I'm from New England, and the New Hampshire state motto is live free or die, literally.
Wow. Wow. Well,
yeah.
I think there's a lot of both going on these days.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But I'm glad to actually have you on. Well, I'm glad everything's going great, man. And I'm glad that I have you on because we're on the heels of an interview I saw and then shared with you with Joe Biden on the Breakfast Club, where he spoke for 18 minutes to try and convince black people to vote for him. And it was pretty cringeworthy, yo. It was hard. Like, even the first 3 minutes, I'm like, man, Jesus Christ, this is awful. And I was offended and, you know, but he just looked really bad. And I think we're in trouble. I mean, we've always been in trouble, but I think now these elections, I think, are going to go in a really bad direction, man.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's I think I shared with you the link. I mean, you saw it like 4 years ago when Hillary went on the Breakfast Club. Charlamagne also exposed her when he asked what was always in her purse, and she said hot sauce because that Beyonce.
She's an idiot. She walked into that one. I don't think. But, you know, I think Charlamagne's actually, you know, I'm very critical of Charlamagne. I listen to his podcast and his shows on and off. But I thought he did a good job in the interview. He asked clear questions. He let Joe talk. You know, he didn't really debate him too much. He asked like maybe a few questions, but they were all good questions. And, you know, it just opened the eyes of many. But we'll see what happens. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's reflective of the bigger political issue, right? Which is just that political elites don't deliver for everyday people, and it's playing out in all kinds of different ways. And you know, like Joe Biden expects to get black votes, and that's why he says crazy stuff. And he went on that show.
I kick their asses, man. Sorry to interrupt. That was just my Uncle Joe in me.
I mean, and he just was not prepared, and it's just, yeah, it was terrible, terrible. And now Trump is putting out t-shirts that say, I ain't black or something, with Joe Biden, quotation marks with Joe Biden, and selling it for, you know, through his Blacks for Trump organization or whatever. But obviously, he's not going to win the black vote, but he just needs a few people, a few thousand people in a couple places, and he wins those districts. He wins those votes. I mean, it's bad.
I mean, he probably needs the same amount he got last time. It is bad. What do you think? Do you think that they gave Biden a game plan before he had the interview, or they were just like, or you think he freestyled? Like, I feel like they were like, be aggressive. You let them know how you help them. You let them know how they've always been on your side. You let them know about the work you've done during the civil rights era. You let them know, Joe, Mr. Vice President. What do you think? Like, I want to know what the game plan was. Like, or they just kind of let him shoot, go loose.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, he's known for making gaffes, right? And for going ad-libbing and going off the cuff and saying stuff that's goes against what the talking points were. Like, they were saying, like, they were talking about how the Obama administration dealt with the swine flu pandemic. And, you know, that's supposed to be like the gold standard. Like, they handled that well, whereas Trump's handling COVID terribly. But, like, Biden went on the Sunday political shows and was like, I wouldn't get on a plane. I wouldn't get my family on a plane. And it freaked everybody out. And the Obama administration had to walk it back. They're like, no, it's fine to fly on airplanes. So like he says, he always goes off the thing. That's like why he has not ever been successful on the national stage. He's run for president so many times. So, but obviously they had a game plan because he had these answers on the crime bill, right? Charlamagne questioned him on it, he's like, he didn't back down. He didn't say, oh yeah, that was bad, I shouldn't have done it. He like doubled down on it.
Yeah.
And maybe that was just like something he did and they said not to do that, but I assume that they had like decided they were not going to admit any weaknesses and just doubled down. And he, you know, he really threw the Congressional Black Caucus under the bus. He kept like blaming them for everything or saying they asked me to support this. They supported this, that, you know, they wanted these things. It was like, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Do your research, man. I mean, I think yeah. It was really bad, obviously, but it's just another way. Go ahead.
No, he's just been also been making bad ever since this. I mean, he's been bad, really bad on the campaign trail, just saying all kinds of mistakes. But his media appearances while he's been in his basement where we're all in lockdown have not also not been good. Either he's like visibly reading from his notes or he says just kind of goes off track. Yeah, anyway, so.
No, it's been bad all around. It's been bad all around, and this has been kind of like, I don't want to call it the dagger in the heart for Democrats coming up in these elections, but it proved the point was that, of course, he takes our votes for granted. Of course, nothing's going to change once you vote for me. Just keep doing what you've been doing.
And did you see that clip of him on MSNBC? Did you see that clip of, on MSNBC with him and Stacey Abrams?
No. No, I did not.
Like, the MSNBC host was like, "So, Joe Biden, why are you here with Stacey Abrams? Why did you invite her on to this show? Do you have an announcement to make?" Like, and she starts getting a big smile, and he has a big smile. Like, they think Joe Biden, it seems like it, they think Joe Biden's going to announce Stacey Abrams as his running mate. And then he says, well, Stacey is really good on protecting the right to vote, and she's very capable, and like the smile drains from her face. And it's like, what the fuck were they doing? Can I swear?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. But it was like, it was a crazy, it was just a crazy thing.
Yeah, I heard that it's going to be Klobuchar. It's going to be Klobuchar.
Yeah.
That's what I heard. I don't think it would have mattered, honestly, unfortunately. I would love it for Stacey Abrams, but I don't think – I've decided early on that it's going to be back-to-back with Trump. You know, I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong, which is what I feel. A friend posted a question on Instagram, you know, since I'm on Instagram all goddamn day. about what are you doing to prepare for 4 more years of Trump? And that was such a question. I couldn't fucking answer it. I'm like, it's a great question. Yeah, but you know, it's a good question. Yeah, that's a question for another day. You gotta like think about that one.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, I don't even want to think about it.
Yeah, no.
I don't even want
to. All right. Well, the moral of the story is Joe Biden looked awful yesterday on the Breakfast Club and didn't make me feel good about things. A lot of things. But
I just gotta say I'm really appreciative of people like Charlamagne and other journalists who I mean I don't even know if you call Charlamagne a journalist, but just people who ask difficult questions of people in power and just hold them accountable.
Yeah.
Mainstream media is not doing it. And it's just, I don't know, people like hip hop morning show DJs, just, you know, hosts. It's thank you, Charlamagne.
Yeah, I know. I also think I saw something, this is the last, I want to touch on this, but I saw someone from MSNBC. I don't know the names of these folks, but who basically made the argument that, you know, Biden really didn't have to say much in terms of trying to be up in the polls, because the more Trump was speaking, the more Trump keeps saying ridiculous things. And even though his base is very loyal, you know, some of them might be like, man, what is he saying? He's telling us to do all these ridiculous things. He clearly is lost up there. But now Joe goes and kind of just self-sabotages himself. He probably is bad strategy. At the same time, you got to show face. But
I mean, there have been reports that There have been reports that his team has been trying to protect him this entire campaign. Like, they were back in July or August, they were like, we're not doing evening events. And I was like, is that because he's like falling asleep?
Asleep.
So like, they've been trying to, you know, restrict as much as possible what people see. And I think, yeah, they were trying to lay low, and then they got all this criticism, like, where's Joe? He should be, we need a leader. We need a national leader. And then, you know, Cuomo and other people stepped up and took the stage. And this is why he can't be that out there, because he says dumb stuff and hurts himself.
Cuomo and his brother are doing a good two-man game in making it's Chris is the CNN host, and the brother, what's his name?
Right.
I don't know, the father was
Andrew.
They have a good two-man game going when he's on them interviews, just give and go like they used to do in the backyard, and he's making Andrew look, you know, fantastic in terms of like a talking head, and people are thinking he's charming and funny, you know, just kind of looking past other things.
Like Starks and Ewing or something?
Yeah, more like I wouldn't say Stockton and Malone, but it's two-man game. Two-man game going.
Yeah.
Anyway, man, I also wanted to ask you, so – correct me if I'm wrong, you are, for work, you work in not necessarily agriculture, but agricultural rights, yeah. Farmers' rights. Yeah. If I want to make sure that the audience has a, an understanding of kind of the field you work in.
Yeah. Human rights and rural development, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that is me.
Toast. Yeah. So since like, you know, COVID and now, I mean, what's kind of like a thing going on, not necessarily something you're working on, but just something that's been very prevalent in kind of the articles you're reading, the things you're doing, maybe work related yeah. that maybe people should know about, but they don't have the time to know about because they're worried about the coronavirus.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think the issues I work on have been super at the front of the news because of concerns around the food chain, right? And the food chain breaking down. Right. Also all the workers in the meat processing plants and in the fields at risk of getting COVID. So yeah, I think people are getting these stories. But the thing that I've learned about agriculture and farming and just rural issues in the U.S. is that the news media doesn't do a good job of really explaining what the realities are. I mean, and very few people live in rural areas anymore. We all live in cities. And so we've been living in cities for generations now. So it's like people kind of forget what that reality is. And so like, you know, you hear all these stories about farmers having to plow food under because they don't have markets anymore. And people go, oh my God, that's so terrible. Why would they do that? These like depraved farmers or something. Donate it, but, or do something with it, give it away. But it's just like the system is so complicated, the food system. And so, siloed in a way that there's just no way, even if there's like a food bank, you know, 10 miles away, there's just no way for that farmer to harvest that stuff and get it to the food bank because they rely on a different company to truck it. And that company only trucks where, you know, to the restaurants or to some supplier.
Right.
The system is just not designed. I mean, it's all privatized. There's very little public, you know, governmental oversight, and there's less and less. And there's just very few entities that can coordinate this kind of stuff. The state governments don't really have strong agencies that track our food system or that monitor our food system. Some places have these food policy councils, but they're mostly just advisory bodies. So it's just, I think it's showing everybody that one of the most important, you know, pieces of the economy, how we produce and consume our food, is so vulnerable to any kind of shock, and that the people who produce our food, the farmers and the workers, are also so vulnerable. And I mean, especially with the workers, just people are the workers in the food system are always invisible, you know.
The workers at the restaurant, if you don't even think about them.
Yeah, restaurants and the supermarkets, but also in especially in the fields and the meat processing plants. I mean, and now we're seeing more about it, and the workers are fighting back. You know, there's lawsuits from a lot of the meat packing workers, and out in Washington State, there's like crazy farm worker labor strikes at a bunch of different farms around, you know, protesting safe working conditions, like not enough PPE, not enough testing, not enough precaution. Because like a lot of the workers, they are provided housing, but their housing, they're all crammed in on each other. I mean, it's basically like barracks.
So they're not making any changes. But this was already a system kind of that just was shoddy in the beginning. And it's kind of like pulling back the curtain a little bit on what that life is like. As you were saying, I heard a story on the Daily a little bit about kind of the plight of right now of the people working in pork factories. That's what you call them, pork factories, but meat processing factories that focus on pork. And it was just kind of a bird's eye view into how wild that lifestyle is and how they treat the workers.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, all the workers are in the food system are primarily migrant workers, primarily from like Central America, but other places as well. And, you know, they have, either they don't have documents and therefore they are not really entitled to any legal protections, or even if they do have documents, like if they're guest workers or something, they have like a legal document, but the company controls their legal status. So if they, you know, speak up, they can just have that, their guest visa, guest worker visa rescinded at any moment.
Wow. And they're sent back. They're like dangling it over them. Like, you better keep quiet or else we'll just send you back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's like, you know, it's this confluence of all these issues of like racism, structural racism in the food system, which has been there in this country since the very beginning, you know, colonialism, since it's primarily, you know, especially from Central America, it's like indigenous workers, peasant farmers who now work in agriculture here. And but it's also extreme economic exploitation. And I don't know. It's, I mean, hopefully if there's a silver lining, it's that people or, you know, food producers recognize their common struggles and connections. Farmers and workers can recognize that they need to work together, and that the workers can kind of lead. They've always been invisible, but you know, they need to be. They're the ones that should be leading the change. They're the ones who experience the most injustice and have a lot of the best agricultural skills and should really be leading the change that we need. The other thing is that, like, everyone, especially, I mean, we live where we live in Baltimore. We have a farmer's market right around the corner, which is like just really nice. And
Oh, that sounds nice.
It is nice, and it's affordable, and I think it's just more people are realizing that you need need access to local farms in this situation when supermarkets are either you could get the virus there or you bare shelves, you know. But the farmer's market, it's all outdoors, and it's just, I don't know, it feels more secure when you have those connections.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and I agree. Being right now at the supermarket is really unsettling. And I'm speaking to another friend who's part of a CSA, and I'm thinking of maybe moving to that. I don't know. I just think when you, you know, this is first world problems. When you're part of a CSA or you go to a farmer's market, you have to eat what they give you instead of being like, oh, I want this. It's like, nope, they gave you Swiss chard. You better figure it out, buddy.
Yeah. No, that's always tricky. See, those CSAs are not those CSAs aren't for everybody. They also give you a ton of stuff. Nah. Like, oh God,
what am I gonna do with this shit? But I find that I like having an abundance of food during the Rona. Not like I overshop, but like I don't like running out of shit. Just I don't know. It's not that I go shopping all the time, but when I do, I just make sure I have what I need. I'm not hoarding anything. If I could hoard something, it'd be like salsa water. But I just think that I want to start thinking about other ways to get produce.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
that's an aside.
I mean, it's just we got to wait and see what's going to happen with the food system. It could, like I'm saying, there are new sort of the potential for forces to align for people to really make some progress on getting a system that really is secure and helps people. But it could also go the other way. You know, more and more people are having to rely on processed food and, you know, Amazon controls Whole Foods now and they do more control over the food system and stuff. So it's, I don't know. It's going to be the next year, 2 years, 3 years. Is it going to be a really important time? And not just for the food system, not just for that sector, but for pretty much every sector of the economy, I guess. See what's going to happen.
Yeah. And it just feels like those issues that have always been there now are taking a backseat to like a global pandemic. That's not even being handled well. They're trying to kind of keep things business as usual. And that's very problematic.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the shock doctrine, right? It's like they always use the playbook is to use a shock to then double down on all the on all the policies and programs that caused the problems in the first place, because usually the powers that be are a lot more organized and can move quicker. But
right.
It seems like everybody is confused, and the pandemic has even the powers that be like on their back foot. So maybe we can make things different this time. I don't know.
Well, I hope so. We'll see. I hope so. You know, optimism is good in this sense. But I wanted to move on, man. I also had you on today because I wanted to talk about The Last Dance. Which finished now a week ago.
I'm just gonna just,
and you and
just
I,
a segue, we need MJ determined winner mentality to win, to make revolution.
That's a good point. That is a good segue. That is a good segue. Mamba mentality, which he got from Jordan, sort of. Yeah. No, you're right. Sticking on to that for a little bit. You know, just the conversations I've been having with people about like change and being frustrated by all these things, about how it has to include us too. We can't kind of sit in the sidelines. I mean, we all do our part, but sometimes, you know, you feel like you could do more. But I also think it's figuring out what that looks like. I think that's change. It's different than maybe ways we could have done it before. Like I've definitely taken my share of protests, but it doesn't feel like that's what this is about anymore. It needs to be more and just finding effective ways to have that MJ mentality to make change.
Yeah, I agree.
But they asked Joe those questions and he ain't got it. He ain't got that mentality. But yeah, but so good segue into The Last Dance, which I enjoyed so much. We've talked about it. You know, we both have similar opinions on certain things and different opinions on other things. But I want to ask you, so tell me what did you like about this documentary? We'll start off with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a documentary about the last actually about the whole Bulls dynasty, right, and Michael Jordan and all the other guys was what I liked about it was it took me back to being a kid into the 90s and mm-hmm. to all those things which were like so formative for me, all the cultural symbols and stories and news and just – you know, iconic images and TV sports moments, but which I kind of had forgotten. And, so that's what I really liked. I mean, when I was a kid, I had this VHS Michael Jordan's Playground that I watched, I don't know, every week, once a week. And,
did he teach you the triangle Jordan offense?
No, I wish. It was all about the story was about this high school kid who tries out for the team and he can't make it and he's all angry Oh, and the coach tells all the kids who don't make the team, like, keep trying, keep working, because even Michael Jordan got cut from his high school team. And then the kids afterwards shooting at this basketball court. And he says, I bet that Michael Jordan never got cut. And then the ball bounces away and Michael Jordan's there and he grabs it. And then he basically tells the kid everything about, yeah, exactly. Bombs the ball. And he tells the kid all about his story. And the whole Michael Jordan mystique thing is just like, he really is like a demigod, you know, like, yeah, that's, so seeing that stuff, that was great.
Yeah, seeing that stuff. I hear you. To me, Jordan is the greatest athlete I've ever in my lifetime. I'm trying to think of people who I saw who were great. So it's like Jordan, Maradona, Messi, I guess Wayne Gretzky, Tom Brady. I didn't really mess with golf too much, but Tiger Woods. Who else has been? I mean, Ronaldo. I don't know, but what about, what didn't you like? I mean, I'm sure we're going to go a little bit more into this. What didn't you like about the documentary? I mean, it was great, but definitely there were some parts where even I was like, huh.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest criticism in its mind too is just that it's not really a documentary. It's when Michael Jordan was a producer or his friends were producers. So it's like, you know, he had final say on everything that came out. So it's not some kind of, objective, quote unquote, or even just detached, disinterested take on what happened with that Bulls team. What was going on with that Bulls team behind the scenes? What's the story? So that's my issue. There are also something that plays out in a couple different ways. One is that, you know, the big one is they address some of the big controversies around Michael Jordan, like, you know, is he a psychopath? and is he addicted to gambling? Did he gamble on the game? You know, is that why he went into retirement? Quote, you know, his retirement, was it actually like a covert suspension and a couple other things? And you know, they dealt with it in the movie by giving it just enough. They interview just enough people to give these like conspiracies or whatever, like enough credibility. But then they bring in the big guns to be like, no, that's not happened. That's David Stern. It's like, come on, you're going to just take his word for it. This is like the most interested guy, like,
water mark the grave.
But I think it would be impossible to like make a documentary about that team, just in general, given how much is at stake for them in terms of money and reputation and all that stuff. And then also just other things, like, you know, they give Steve Kerr a lot of attention and they ask him a lot of questions, and there's one whole episode like about a shot that he took, and like, he was not that important on the team. He's a really important person in basketball.
Right now.
So that's why they did that. But like, Tony Kukoc was a much more integral part of that team.
Yeah, they didn't do enough on Tony, man. They had him in the Olympic part, and then that's about it. Tony Kukoc was their third best player. Between three and four. I think towards the end, he was definitely their third best player.
Yeah, I mean, they focus a lot on Rodman, which makes sense, but like, I mean, especially in the finals, Kukoc was amazing in that the finals, the 98 finals. He was scored like 30 points. I don't know what he averaged
in one of the games.
And a lot of people pointed out, I mean, shout out to NBA and NBA discussion subreddit for giving me a lot of good discussion points. But like,
shout out
there's
to
one scene that they cover in one of the finals games that they touch on, where Jordan was like making a lot of shots, but I think they still lost, and he like airballs the last shot that they show. But like, people pointed out that they didn't show the full clip. Like the final shot, the play had been written by Phil Jackson for Tony Kukoc to catch and shoot three. Mm-hmm. And Jordan ran and intercepted the pass and took the shot himself, like a kind of wild turnaround. And they didn't even mention that in the documentary. They just said, like, oh, Jordan took the last shot, but he missed it. He tried really hard, but he, like, couldn't – his will wasn't enough or whatever. But, like, it was just kind of weird. And the – yeah, I don't know. So that was weird.
And then when Scotty got mad over the same thing, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, and I think, yeah, they did Scotty dirty.
You think so? I've been hearing that. And I think to the documentary, what happened that showed Scotty in a semi-negative light? I mean, him getting the surgery done in the season, which Shaq has done also, that Knicks playoff game, and then the migraine shit. I mean, I don't know, man. I don't think anyone's looking at Scotty in a negative light. I felt bad that he got lowballed by the Bulls.
Yeah. I didn't know about that.
To me, that's the biggest thing. Me neither. I didn't know that either. They paid him nothing. But then his daughter went on the record on Twitter being like, we're good. We made over 100, you know, hopefully, you know, this guy looks like he saved his money. But he made a lot of money when he was over the hill.
Yeah.
In Houston, in Portland and in Houston.
I would like a documentary about that Portland Trailblazers team that he was on.
The one that lost in game 7 team. Jack. Yeah. They were good. They were really good.
But they didn't really, I mean, everything was subtle, right? So it wasn't so much that they really hammered Scotty with any of that stuff, but it was just like Jordan got the last word on all, it seemed like Jordan got the last word on him and was just kind of like, you know, he didn't say, oh, Scotty's weak because of the migraine, but like it's implied that you just get the sense that people think Scotty's mentally weak, that he, and because of the Knicks thing, because of the surgery thing, because of the migraine thing. And then they try to redeem him with his back thing.
Game six. Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just, you know, it's very subtle that, but it's just the picture. You know, they start off by being when they introduce him in like episode 2 or whatever, it's like, oh, he's so great, Jordan couldn't have done it without him. But then throughout the rest of the documentary, it's like he's actually like
weak.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, maybe Jordan needed him, but like he needed Jordan. He needed Jordan more than Jordan needed him, or I don't know. It just kind of made me feel like I don't think it was wrong necessarily, but it just didn't make it feel like it was an unbiased take. I just don't think they should have let Jordan have the final word. They should have interviewed more people or whatever. Oh, the last thing. Oh, sorry. I'm talking a lot, but the last thing.
No, go for it. I'm interested in doing this. This is a
good okay. The take. Last thing, not about Pippen, but the last issue with the documentary is just how they just throw Jerry Krause completely under the bus.
So you're defending a little bit.
I'm defending Jerry Krause a little bit, but he's the only one who wasn't interviewed because he's dead. Like they pile on him being like, oh yeah, he was a little guy and he had huge ego issues and couldn't deal with Phil Jackson and didn't really like that Phil and Jordan and everyone were getting all the attention. And he was like one of the greatest GMs, you know, to put that team together, and he didn't get enough credit and blah, blah, blah. And obviously all those things were a factor and were probably a big factor, but also like, you know, Jordan and Pippen constantly made fun of him. And, you know, they say Jordan's like the best trash talker ever. Like, I don't know. There's just all these factors. And obviously, in Reinsdorf, the owner, he's signing off on everything Jerry Krause is doing, and he's obviously like...
Right. Reinsdorf got away scot-free, and I think that's one of the biggest things for me, which I'll get into a little bit more. But I interrupted you. Sorry about that. But Reinsdorf got off scot-free.
Yeah, no, that's basically it. I mean, he comes across as being a very... I don't know what the right adjective is, but just being a kind of ruthless... That's a little extreme, but being a very tough businessman and, I don't know. And yeah, he gets off scot-free, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that, you know, Mike was talking about getting everybody back. I definitely think they could have won seven. That next year, the Spurs won. They beat my Knicks. I remember that in six. Spree Houston Camby could have stopped Michael Jordan and washed up Patrick Ewing, who's been diagnosed with the coronavirus. So I hope he gets better. Shout out to him as he's listening to my podcast.
You never know.
But you never know. But I think it would have been too complicated. Pippen wanted more money, and Rodman was kind of not the same Rodman who began that second three-peat. But it would have been interesting to watch,
though. Yeah, what Jordan said, they could have – because, like, what, Kraus and Reinsdorf saw the writing on the wall. The team was old, breaking down. They couldn't, you know, re-sign a bunch of guys to big contracts for a lot of years, but they could – Jordan said, maybe you do one – you pay everybody for 1 year, and then we try and get seven. Is that – that's what you're talking about? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Nobody really rebuts that idea, but Phil says it was time to go. That makes sense to me. I generally trust the only person I really trust in that whole documentary is Phil Jackson. Yeah.
Really? So let me get into kind of what I liked and didn't like.
Yeah, go for it.
I had some issues with Phil. So what I liked is kind of similar to your answer. It's just what you said. It just brought me back to being a kid again and just remembering what it was like to watch this guy dominate. And I was just so happy that I was just – everything he was doing still had me in awe, you know? I was just like – I remember those things when I was a kid, and I just see it again, like standing up and cheering. Like for me, the first time I started remembering basketball was the 92 playoffs. My cousin's dad was staying with us for a time, and then he was into basketball, and that's how I got in. So 92, I'm like, what, nine? And I'm just remembering those playoffs, Bulls, Cavs, Bulls, Blazers, the Jordan shrug game. And then the next year I became a huge Knicks fan to watch him ruin it for us. And then, you know, the rest is history in terms of being a Knicks fan, but just seeing him still have that aura and just how smooth everything looked. And he made everything look effortless, but you could see that there was a lot of work put in. How ruthless he was, how he just snatched the souls of so many Hall of Famers. I think he fucked, you know, I think Malone is fucked up in the head partially because of the way he lost twice to MJ. Fucked up in the head meaning, like, you know, he's gone through a lot. He doesn't look happy. He should be. He's a Hall of Fame basketball player. But just also taking you back, the documentary did a great job with the music, putting you in that mindset. Like his final game in Madison Square Garden where they were playing If I Rule the World by Nas and Lauryn Hill. I was like, are you kidding me, man? It literally lifted my spirits up. Or his last game in Atlanta. It was great. And like I said, again, just watching him, just reliving those moments, just watching him dominate. I really, really enjoyed that. And just seeing those players I idolized growing up, like him and Kobe meeting him, and that was really nice. I thought they did a nice touch with adding a bit of Kobe in there. So those are the things that I liked the most, just, again, reliving those moments. What I didn't like is, you know, I really enjoyed the documentary, so I can criticize it. I think some of the slights you gave it are eye-opening to me. Like, I didn't look at it that way, and I could totally understand it. I thought Phil Jackson got away pretty scot-free. I mean, look, what Jerry Krause did to him was pretty low, being like, this is your last year. But I guess I'm looking at it from the future, looking at the past. Like, Phil Jackson had bad exits in Chicago, the Lakers, and the Knicks. And, you know, there's always some sort of criticism on the organization. But Phil is the easiest person to work with. I mean, his skill set is really, I mean, he's a great coach, but I think it's being able to control egos. He's a mastermind at it. He gets into your head with whatever the fuck he's talking about. He does it. So that's one thing I didn't like. I also didn't like, it's not about what the documentary itself, but what it what's come from it is that people they're criticizing today's players, like people who are LeBron haters are really using this as a way just to attack, attack, attack. And can't we just like enjoy the documentary for what it was, that Michael Jordan was the great player, arguably the greatest player of all time, without using it to shit on other people? I mean, it's just can't we just stop? Like, come on, like, let the man be great in his own right. But it's hard for me to say what I didn't like. It obviously wasn't the perfect documentary. But for, I think, what people are going through now, not having sports, it was a good turn back in time. But I'm happy that it's over in a sense. Like, I don't need 3 more weeks of
this. Yeah, I guess so. No, I thought it was great. I mean, it was I agree with you. The going back to the 90s was, I mean, because it's not just like that's when we were growing up, but also like that was an amazing time in American culture, right? Like you're pointing out the music, and it was just, there was just something that was like special about that time, and we were lucky to grow up then. And you know, did you ever see the 30 for 30 about Bo Jackson?
No.
Oh man, no, I have time. You should watch it. It's really good. What's his name? Chuck Klosterman does a lot of the narrating and the gives a lot of the commentary. But like the way they frame it, I don't want to give too much away because I don't want to spoil your viewing of it. But it's really good because also, you know, Bo Jackson came up at the same time. But like they really play up this idea that he was mythical, you know, like a tall tale type, like a figure out of American tall tales. He was just bigger, stronger, faster. And he was like that. The stories about him as a kid are like just ridiculous too. Legendary. But one thing that Chuck Klosterman says is that like, not only did Bo Jackson come up, not only was he amazing, but he came up right in this moment in the early 90s when there was so much, cultural, I guess, progress, I would say, but just so much cultural energy. And when the world, you know, the Cold War had ended and the developments in media were really taking off, I think like through technology, through TV and cable and these kinds of things, that they were able to project these images around the world. And like basically the Nike ad campaigns of Bo Jackson and Michael Jordan were transformative on the world stage. And that's kind of what it reminded me of again. Like there was this moment where it just, and actually Obama talks about it, I guess, in The Last Dance, that it's like Jordan's like biggest impact is what he did for world culture or for American, exporting American culture around the world or whatever.
Yeah. And they were able to, yeah, absolutely right. He did do that, and you know, they did a really good job of showing kind of the, at least in the Last Dance stock, of how globally Mike changed the game. I thought they also did a good job in kind of hinting at how he didn't do much for the black community, and I thought that he still gets away scot-free. People are like, yeah, you know, Mike said that about the Republicans buy shoes too, but you know, man, look at that fadeaway. And I think, you know, when LeBron does retire, people are going to start to realize like, wow, everything this guy's done for the culture, for black youth, black boys especially. I mean, just in general, opening a school and just trying to put things in order where he is doing more than just playing basketball. I think Mike was the first one, kind of the pioneer in showing how to make money or how to brand yourself. Well, LeBron really, I think, perfected it. But all in all, yeah, I appreciate taking me back into the 90s. I'm definitely going to check out that Bo Jackson, because if you know, it's a great way to keep sports going on in some sort of fashion.
Yeah, that's a good one. About Phil though, just what you said about Phil Jackson in the documentary. I guess what I appreciated about his parts is that you can tell he's being very careful with his words. And he is trying not to throw anyone under the bus. I could just tell he's not using this as an opportunity to, I just felt like he was being more careful and more respectful in the documentary with people's reputations, than some other people were. Name
like Michael Jordan.
Michael Jordan was like, Gary Payton thinks he was a tough defender. Psh, no, like stuff like that. So
I had no problem with the glove.
Yeah. But also the part about were you going to say, you have something to say about Phil, about what I said about Phil?
No, I was going to ask you. So you're talking about present day Phil when they were interviewing.
Oh yeah. Right? Yeah. Present day Phil.
Yeah. No, I mean, Phil knows what he's doing. But quickly before you continue, Reinsdorf didn't get any blame, at all. And his responses were weak. So he's another one that got away. But I really enjoyed, even though, you know, Mike being like the glove wasn't a problem, I enjoyed the rawness, man. Sure. I mean, that's what he was and he still is. And I loved it. I loved it. And Gary Payton talks so much trash in general. And lucky for a glove, he got his ring in Miami. I'm actually very happy he did, because I think he was the best point guard of that. That there was that window right there. Let me ask you this question. Did you find yourself watching it, even though basketball's changed a lot, just kind of looking at how bad some of these coaches were, or just poor defense? Like, I'm watching some of these playoff series. I'm watching Seattle, and just George Karl was just not a very good defensive coach, or just did a lot of things like on inbounds play. Like, there were things about him where he was just not as refined as some of the greater coaches that we see. Same thing with like Jerry Sloan, who recently passed away, RIP, but just some of the things they were doing. It's like, why is that guy? Why is, you know, Jeff Hornacek the one guarding Michael Jordan? Or there was a Hornets series. Why is BJ Armstrong on Michael Jordan? Like, what are you thinking? Like, why don't you throw a double team? Like, what's going on? And if you're George Karl, of course you have Gary Payton on Michael Jordan. Maybe not for the entire series, but for the majority of it. You don't wait till you're down 3-0 and then put him on. Like, Glove is a Hall of Fame defender. And, like, yes, Mike still probably would have won, but you have to give yourself a chance.
Yeah, I think that's what people always say, right? I mean, obviously the quality of play has increased dramatically. Not only the athleticism of the players, but also the degree to which the complexity of the strategies and the effort that people put into it is changing, right? Like in the 60s and 70s, people on teams, it was like their part-time job. They worked other jobs when the season was over. Like, they didn't pay very much. There wasn't much money involved. It was like, you know, they'd say like it was against milkmen, you're playing against milkmen and plumbers and stuff. Like, obviously it's big business. There's a ton of money. There's so much training. There's so much, I mean, the game is really complex. And if you don't give like 110%, you don't have a roster spot. And so, yeah, I think probably all that, I don't know if that's like what you're, if that would explain what you're talking about, because I don't know if it's, I don't know. My basketball.
When focusing on defense.
No, I didn't notice that stuff. I don't really know. I wish I was better at understanding how the game is played, but.
No, me too, for sure. I just think that in some of the instances I saw where it just had smaller defenders on Michael Jordan, and he was just backing him down. Like, you know, it wasn't until he got to like the Pacers series where they were like beating him up. And that was, I remember that 7-game series. And I think I was for the Pacers back then, because I just, despite the fact that Reggie Miller was a Knick killer, I just kind of wanted to see that team. It was like Reggie, Mark Jackson, Chris Mullin, who went to St. John's down the street from where I grew up, and Larry Bird is the coach, and Jalen Rose, like, Jalen Rhodes, Fab Five, Denver. I was like a fan of that team, and they had it. And then
I think that was my favorite sequence, or my favorite episode, especially the stuff with Reggie. I mean, he's I don't know. I mean, comparing basketball in the 90s to basketball today, it seemed like there was just more magic in the 90s, like just mm-hmm. more brilliance than what you, and I don't know if that's because they just let people play more, but just I'm thinking of that Reggie Miller, like 8 points in 8 seconds thing, and just and Jordan yeah. just having this ability to pull out wins. It's just, it seemed, it was, maybe this just all luck, maybe it's all just, you know, just random, but or it's selective. I'm being selective, and just because I remember that I was at an age in my life when everything seemed magical, but these people yeah. seemed unbeatable. But like, I don't know. The getting back to that also just seemed like really amazing. I guess like Steph,
yeah.
like Steph probably has that magical quality, being able to hit shots from everywhere. Golden State probably has that for young people now, but. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the other thing about Phil, getting your question about or your point about coaching, the thing that's always so refreshing about Phil Jackson, or the thing that I like take away from watching those clips of Phil Jackson coaching, and how he has to always come up with like a theme. He, you know, comes up with a theme for the year to get everyone kind of bought in, which is that this is the last dance, because like these are all yeah. you know, grown men. Getting paid money, and they're celebrities. Like, what are they going to do? Listen to him. He's telling them to work harder, you know, like, so he's always got to come up with these ways to like motivate. His is always like by tapping into some deeper spiritual, philosophical meaning. You know, you're not doing this because I'm saying this to tell you to do this, or because this is how you win, but like, this is how you're going to fulfill what you most want or something. And
yeah,
I mean, I bet George Kyle just can't motivate people to play defense. I bet a lot of coaches can't.
Probably not. No, probably not. But Phil had them all bought in. One last thing that I want to talk about, what I like so much about this is it brought back that feeling when you used to watch Michael and it was just like, he's not going to lose. Like, he's not going to lose. Like, I know they're down, but I know somehow he's going to pull this off. And I don't think any players now make you feel that way. Maybe like, you know, Kawhi a teeny tiny bit, where sometimes Kawhi, when he has it going, you could just tell he's not going to let his team lose. Like the thing with LeBron, unfortunately, as great as he is, I think we just used to seeing him lose in big spots so much. By big spots, yeah. I mean like finals, not necessarily like him blowing it or anything like that. Because if you could, you know, go finals by finals, I think – that Dallas one is the one where he really played poorly, and all the other ones he was pretty incredible. I mean, that first one against the Spurs where they swept them, there's like a Hall of Fame team against him and like Boobie yeah. Gibson and Danielle Marshall and Jadrinal Ilgauskas. But you don't get that feeling with other players where you're like, yo, they're not going to lose. But with Mike, it was just like, there's going to be a fadeaway somewhere where it's going to cow and it's just going to just snatch the soul of not only that other player, but that entire arena.
I think the only player that I've felt that way about in the last couple of years is Durant on the Warriors. Like,
yeah, well, on the best team of
yeah.
in the fucking universe. Yeah.
No, you're right. But I think you're totally right. That feeling that Jordan couldn't lose. I mean, that was like, that feeling to me was like so reassuring. It just in all facets of life, it was like, the one thing I know for sure is that in this world is that Michael Jordan will not lose. And especially coming from New England, where in the 90s, our sports teams where you just always expected them to lose. It was really, really great to be, to have Michael Jordan and the Bulls. Cause they were just so easy to be a fan of.
Yeah. Yeah, with that, man, I know we had said that we were going to talk for an hour. You have two little ones to raise. So thank you very much, man, for taking the time today to chat a little bit about everything.
Hey, my pleasure. Yeah, it was a good conversation. We've needed to have this debrief.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to give any special shout outs to anyone who might be listening?
No, to friends and family. Stay safe. Be well. Miss you guys. Miss seeing people in person these days. But
Absolutely.
Yeah, but absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Absolutely, man. Thanks a lot. Cool. I will do this again soon.
And I hope to see you sometime soon.
Yeah,
but yeah, peace. Peace.